This is an advertisement for BetterHelp Therapy Online. There are so many things that kids are curious about and they just have no fear diving in to learn something new.
Yeah, like how to do a wheelie.
Yeah. And then as we grow older, we don't take the time out to learn new things. But curiosity doesn't have to be lost to childhood. Thankfully, therapy can help you reconnect with your inner child and get you excited to learn and grow again.
Now, I might not be able to teach you how to do a wheelie, but it helps give you the skills to get back on the bike no matter how many times you've fallen off.
If you're thinking about starting therapy, then why not give BetterHelp a try?
All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge.
And it's entirely online, making it convenient, flexible, and suitable no matter your schedule.
With over 5,000 therapists available, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise.
Rediscover your curiosity with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/bollocks to get 10% off your first month.
That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BOLLOX.
Go loud.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your weight in the ground. Tell your body okay. Walk it hard and long. When you finish that.
The hypnoga.
We're here for a special episode of Talking Bollocks. This is to celebrate Science Week 2024. So it's me, CLB.
It's me, 30 Flower.
Science Week is a national celebration of science with hundreds of events for people of all ages taking place across Ireland from the 10th to the 17th of November.
From protecting our natural world, creating more sustainable approaches to energy supply, embracing technology advancements, and investigating new solutions to safeguard our health, it's time to reimagine the way we engage with the world around us and enhance our collective strengths.
Let's celebrate our innate ability to reinvent, rejuvenate, and regenerate. For more information about Science Week 2024 and a full list of events taking place, visit scienceweek.ie.
And today we're joined by Annie Curtis, who is a Professor of Circadian Immunology at RCSO University of Medicine and Health Science. Annie, straight away, off the bat, I want to ask you, gene editing, explain it to us in the most simplest terms possible, please.
Okay.
It sounds trickier than what it is, because we've been talking off air and you're explaining it. I'm like, right, I can kind of get this. But gene editing is something what we want to speak about.
Okay, so I suppose let's break it down, okay? And I think first of all into two bits. Let's just talk about what a gene is first, because no point in talking about editing a gene if we haven't understood what a gene is first. So, you know, genes are in your DNA. That's when we talk about genes, they're kind of written into your DNA. And I think a good way to think about it is a gene is like a recipe, right? It's like a recipe for something. And genes make proteins. So think about genes as a recipe and proteins as being the product of the recipe. So like a cake, right, is a product of the recipe. And proteins, we've all heard of proteins, right? But like proteins pretty much are what make us up. You know what I mean? It's what fills us up. You know, it's the stuffing. We are just a bunch of proteins. So for example, there's a protein called collagen. Okay, so collagen, those in the beauty industry are well aware of collagen because collagen is a protein in the skin and it's all about, these beauty products are all about, you know, boosting collagen production, because if you boost collagen production, you look like, you know, really young. You know, if 80-year-old woman could look like 60-year-old woman, right? Or, well, that might be a bit of an extravagance. But so each gene then is making a different protein, right? And you know, some of us, say if we keep the analogy of the cake, right, some of us may have a recipe for collagen, but the recipe might include 50 grams of sugar. So they'll make a nice bit of collagen, enough to survive and all of that. But then say somebody else might have their recipe for collagen in their genes, might have 100 grams of sugar, right? And that's going to make a much sweeter cake, right? And maybe that's better, you know, and maybe they're the people who don't age that as much. You know, we've all seen them, you know, women, men, they look maybe 10 or 15 years younger than their like biological age. So, you know, what we have then in terms of gene editing then, so that is basically taking that recipe and maybe changing it a little bit. Okay. And I know I'm after giving the example of collagen and sort of the beauty area and all of that. But for the most part, when we're talking about gene editing, we're talking about trying to take a recipe for a protein where that recipe it doesn't have sugar at all. It actually has salt, right? So it's 50 grams of salt. So that product is really not working well. You know, that's not going to give you a cake at all. Okay. So with gene editing, what we're trying to do is we're trying to take the gene and maybe just tinker with it, especially if it's a gene that's causing disease. And I think we'll get to that in a little bit. If it's a gene that's causing disease, like really serious diseases, you know, that are really life-threatening and really debilitating for individuals, and we know the gene that is causing it, so we can basically look at that recipe and say, oh, look, there's 100 grams of salt in that recipe. We're going to go in and we're going to change it back to 50 grams of sugar. And that's going to kind of make that gene functional again. So that's gene editing 101.
Yeah. No, it sounds good. Yeah. No, so at first, when I was first hearing that gene editing was the topic today, I was like, oh, shit.
Holy heck. Yeah. Holy
yeah. Yeah. Who's Gene?
Right, yeah.
And I was confused. When you're breaking it down like that with the recipes, it does make a lot more sense.
But I think a lot of people would think the same thing, because I was quizzing you off air. I was like, how many genes is that? Because like, I always hear stuff like, this person is genetically better than that person. And you do hear it in athletes. You know, like, oh, he's a genetic specimen. And I'm like, so this fellow was just born to be great. He was just, no matter what, like, he has something in him that we don't have. But you are telling us off air there's like 20,000 genes that everybody has. It's just how they're made up. And that's what the recipe is.
The recipe, exactly. So, you know, if you think about 20,000 recipes, but there might be slight differences in everyone's recipe, you know. So I gave the recipe for the cake, but obviously there's different recipes because we're coding for different proteins. You know, everyone, just slight differences, you know what I mean, in the ingredients. And that's what gives the diversity that we see. Now, when you are talking about like athletes, like what you have to remember is with genetics and inheritance and all of that, you know, these athletes who, you know, are fantastic at their sport, you know, chances are they came from a family, their mom and dad, you know, so they passed down those recipes that were just right, you know, in terms of like doing the high jump or doing the 100 meter sprint or whatever. So it's not like somebody kind of appears out of nowhere with this, you know, with this set of genes. They obviously get them, you know, it's passed down from them, get them from their mom and dad and from their granny and grandparents and stuff like that. And that's why I think, especially for things like, you know, sports and stuff like that, you see it in families, don't you? Now, there's kind of a nature nurture because, okay, they might be born with genes that make them, you know, quite good at hurling, let's say, for example. But then they're in a family where everyone is picking up a hurley and, you know what I mean, like bouncing a slitter for most of the day. So, you know, it's both of those things that kind of give the person, you know what I mean, those, I suppose, skills and traits and whatever that we were talking about.
Yeah. What has the journey been like in the technology of gene editing from the start to where it is now?
Yeah, so that's actually a good one, Terence, because when we were talking about inheritance, like really when we think about gene editing, it really started out when we had to figure out about inheritance. You know, so back in, you know, 1700s and 1800s, people didn't understand. You know, we didn't understand the structure of DNA. We didn't understand that there was DNA in cells. We didn't understand any of that. They could tell for sure inheritance happened, you know. So if there was a mom and a dad that both had, you know, certain features, they were passed on to their child and again and again and again. And it was actually a monk, I think, in what was Czechoslovakia, they called Mendel. So he was kind of, if you talk about the real grandfather of genetic editing, he was the guy who was basically, you know, putting different peas together, you know, so like not mate because like, peas don't mate as such, if you know what I mean. But anyway, but put it, you know, crossing different strains of peas and looking how the traits move down through the generations. So, he was the guy who kind of understood inheritance, and that led to basically modern genetics as we know it today. And then in about the 1970s, there was a bit of activity around kind of recombinant DNA technology. So this was when they figured out that they could sort of insert genes mainly into kind of microorganisms like bacteria and stuff like that. So that was kind of the next stage, right? And then there was a couple of different technologies kind of back in the 90s and early noughties where they were basically using these enzymes called nucleases. So So enzymes are proteins as well. So they come from a recipe, right? And these nucleases were basically able to snip DNA. And they were like, oh, you know, so we at this point now we understood DNA was the material of inheritance. We understood it was in a certain area in the cell. We understood it was given rise to like all our traits, like it was the genetic material, the genetic blueprint. So I think there was TALENs and ZFNs. These were kind of used, and we could snip the DNA, so we could kind of tinker a little bit with the recipe, but it wasn't very accurate, you know, and it was really costly. So it just wasn't able to be sort of applied, you know, across the board. It was kind of specialized and stuff like that. Mm. And I think this is where, if we were to kind of give an example of why we should like fund lots of different types of science, is these guys, back in the noughties, they discovered that bacteria who had been infected with viruses. Now, I know you could, like, I would think, okay, is a bacteria an infectious agent and viruses are infection agents, but they actually can infect each other. And viruses, as we know from COVID, they're tricky things, you know, they really are. So these viruses are able to infect bacteria, and bacteria, in order to kind of save themselves, had this mechanism called CRISPR, which we call CRISPR, to basically cut it out. So it was cutting out these sequences, these viral sequences out of DNA. And, you know, scientists went, that's important, right? But like, no, you know, they didn't go looking for a gene editing tool. People were just understanding how bacteria respond to viruses. So, you know, it's I suppose, it's an argument to fund lots of different science, and like blue sky science, you know, where you kind of don't really know what you're going to look for until you start looking for it.
Yeah.
And then the biggest, the biggest advancement was back in like 2012, two ladies, which is great to hear, two female scientists, whoop whoop, they ended up really making the big discovery in that they figured out that you could actually kind of load this CRISPR molecule with a guide strand, and that would kind of bring the CRISPR to certain parts, to very specific parts. So I could, you know, you could say to CRISPR, please go to the collagen recipe, you know, and take out this piece of DNA. And that's what they discovered. And that was just groundbreaking. So that once that happened, that just threw the whole field completely open, in that this was a technology that was very specific. It's actually quite easy to use, and it's very adaptable, and it's very safe and stuff like that. So that's, I suppose, you know, Terrence, in a long-winded way, yeah, that's where it's been incremental steps, you know, along the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how do we implement this? So you're talking about editing genes. Can we get our genes edited now, or is this something that has to be like from birth, or while you're in the womb, in development, or what way does this work?
So yeah, that's a good question. Like, you know, theoretically we can edit them anywhere, so when you're a fetus, but that has huge ethical implications, because that's, you're editing the germline, so you're editing DNA that's going to get passed on to future generations, and that's something that I don't think anyone wants at the moment. But yes, we can. It's still, in terms of like kind of the medical area for human, you know, treatment, it's still pretty much early days. Like, we are editing genes in terms of cancer treatment. Actually, that's already being done. So we're taking out a type of immune cell called a T cell, and we're kind of tinkering with its a very important receptor on that T cell, and we're putting that back into a patient. And those T cells have become kind of cancer, really cancer fighting machines. So that's really useful in terms of cancer. We're looking at it in terms of cystic fibrosis, which is, you know, a condition that affects your lung. The individuals build up a load of mucus, you know, and that is caused by a couple of genes as well. So it's, you know, any conditions where we really know the genes that are causing this condition, it's quite clear, can potentially be used for gene editing.
Right. And can, like, do we do this like as adults? So like, for example, let's say Parkinson's was running in someone's family. Can you get like people in as young adults and say like, we're going to give you this treatment for using CRISPR or something? Or what way does, how do you apply?
Yeah, you could. Like, theoretically, again, none of these things are really widespread at the moment. Like, and theoretically, we could do that. You know, somebody who might have Huntington's disease, that's a condition where you have these kind of extra repeats on the Huntington gene. That's quite, you know, if you kind of think about it, okay, you're looking at something that you can really just snip out and kind of make that gene or that recipe better able to function. And again, you know, if somebody has this, the gene with this kind of very long end to it, you'll know that from early on. You can do a genetic test on that from early on. So there's no reason why you couldn't do that for an individual then at an early stage. But I think, you know, it's mainly, you know, conditions like, yeah, cystic fibrosis, and muscular dystrophy as well, as they're looking at it in terms of that. Cancer is obviously a big one as well. And then I suppose the condition that we were speaking about earlier off air, which was epidermolysis bullosa, which I find that a hard one to pronounce. But
don't we all? I'm glad you did it.
It's EB. So this was the condition that Emma Fogarty has. And she was on the Late Late Show there the other week with Colin Farrell, because he was running the marathon to raise money for the organisation, which is called DEBRA, which raises funds and provides support for individuals with this condition. And I suppose there's a reason why I started with collagen, because in EB, it is collagen that is one of the genes that is wonky, let's call it. And what this collagen 7, which is the one that's wonky in EB, what it does is it holds basically the top layer of your skin with the middle layer, basically holds that. It's like an anchor, right? Because it's a protein that does something. And individuals have this condition then, basically the top layers of their skin just slough off. And like it's so, I can only imagine, you know, you can imagine how sore it is when you get a cut. You know what I mean? Where this is somebody who, you know, a lot of their skin, especially on their arms and their legs, you know, is just not functional anymore. And that condition is really good if you think about gene editing. You know, we kind of know one of the genes. Another thing that's great about it is we can apply something topically. So we can, you know, maybe use the CRISPR kind of and just have it as a cream almost. Yeah. Now, we're not there yet, but we're, you know, this is what
in theory,
that's what you could have. And you could have it as a cream and you could, you know, get the CRISPR into the cells and get them, you know, to make that gene not wonky. And then, you know, that would provide, you know, a lot of relief for these individuals.
Yeah. What are some of the current and future diseases that gene editing will be able to treat?
So I think, you know, there's a lot, right? Because there's a lot of genetic diseases that we know. But, you know, even, I suppose, turns outside of, I think everyone's mind goes to medical conditions, yeah. Don't we? You know, there's a lot that can be done with CRISPR outside of, and gene editing outside of medical conditions. So like anything, I was just thinking about this, like anything in nature where you might want to change it. So I suppose I'll give you an example. Say you want to create microorganisms, bacteria, that are really good at going into an oil spill and clean it up. Like, what you could do then is you could, so maybe they already have that feature a bit, you know, but they're like the 50 grams of sugar, you know what I mean? Yeah. You want to get them to the 100 grams of sugar, you know, so you could gene edit those microorganisms then to be able to like clean up an oil spill, right?
So it's not just on humans.
It's not, absolutely. And I think probably as much work will be done on, you know, non-human medical areas than on the human medical areas. So for example as well, even in plants, you know, and if we think about climate change, like we have these countries now that are, you know, a lot of them in very poor areas that are just going to be devastated by climate change. You know, I think we're, you know, I don't think we don't feel as much the impacts of climate change as, you know, other countries do. And so the crops that are there now just will not be able to survive. So we can use CRISPR there to modify. And that had been done, you know, we've heard of genetically modified organisms. Like that's gene editing as well. But we can use CRISPR to do that, to make it a lot more efficient and stuff. So to generate crops that are more resistant to heat, let's say, or can survive when the seasons change and things like that. And then there was one other one, and I thought you guys would like this, is that we could so they're tinkering and investigating whether we can kind of store data on DNA. So DNA and I can't even get my head really around how they're going to do this, but DNA, for example, has a much higher storage capacity than what we have now. So you think about data storage. Well, you know, I was only talking to a guy and we were talking about the fact that, you know, AI, you know, in all these, the data centers, right? Yeah. So, you know, we think data centers are places where they're just storing pictures of our cats and our dogs. But actually a lot of the energy that they're using for data storage is now for AI. So they're saying that AI is actually going to be as bad as flying soon, right, in terms of impact on the climate and stuff like that. So DNA could be a solution there, that you could actually store information. So you could kind of, and you could use CRISPR for that. So, you know, we could be writing your podcast, for example, in the future on DNA. And then I was thinking, you know, that it's like talking bollocks might literally be in your DNA, you know, before we know it.
So some might say it's already there. It's not,
yeah.
That's a descending me a bit west.
So there's a lot of concern in the media about designer babies. Do you want to explain to us what designer babies is, and then if it's actually a real threat or not? I know that sounds mad. Designer babies.
It's only when you said it. Yeah. I was like, this is actually a topic.
Like, think about it. Designer babies.
But yeah.
Okay, right. So and it's not, you know, it's not to be laughed at for sure, but so I suppose the idea of designer babies has come from the idea that, yeah, could we go in and start tinkering with the fetus, for example, and start changing genes within the fetus? And you might think, okay, well, you know, if you knew that a child was going to have a certain condition, that's a different situation. But if you're just doing it to improve things like intelligence, or not that you need it, lads, or, you know, I'm speaking designer podcasters, I think, here, but you like intelligence, or, you know, how you look, or, you know, or even certain things like height. Like, I do know, there was an experiment done, which where in China, where they actually put together like the two tallest people in China. I don't know if you heard of this, right? like really tall, like male and female. And they produced a really tall, a baby who became really tall. Because he's a very famous.
They put them together. What do you mean you put them together?
You know what?
They made them breed as if they were two dogs.
I think they brought them out on a date, bought them dinner. You know what I mean? Got a good wine going. You know what I mean?
It's like, I know people that do that with their dogs. Yeah, like, your dog looks nice and my dog looks nice.
Exactly. And I've heard of that as well. So I suppose, but the idea, I think where the idea of designer babies would come from is from gene editing. That, like, yeah, could you go in? And look, no, I don't, there's lots of rules and regulations to stop that happening. Now, it did happen once, not in terms of creating a designer baby. I don't know if you heard about this, but back, I think in 2018, there was a Chinese scientist and he basically did gene editing on the fetus of two baby, a twin girls, right? And he tinkered with one gene, one recipe, which was for a protein called CCR5. Now, CCR5 is the protein that allows HIV, the virus HIV, to get into immune cells. So he basically kind of cut that gene off, right, so that these children would be resistant to HIV. Now, there was huge uproar when this became known. It was all done very much in secrecy. There was, you know, there was no approvals gotten. You know, it was very much done in secrecy. Huge uproar across the world about this. For one, you know, these were healthy babies. Why would you do this to, like, healthy babies? Where, you know, it's not as if they were infected with HIV. There was none of that, you know, from, I think from his point of view, it was an experiment to see if it could be done. And as well as that, like, we don't know enough about off, we call it off-target effects. So say in that situation, the target is CCR5. It's that protein that allows the virus in. We talk about off-target effects. So like, they're just things that just happen by tinkering with cells like this, you know, that you just didn't mean for them to happen. And that's always your biggest concern. It's not what you know, it's what you don't know, you know. Yeah. It's what you don't know that's going to happen. And changing something in the germline, which is that they are the cells that, you know, these twin babies will pass on this gene to their children and their children and their children. You know, that's really dangerous because, first of all, we don't know the off-target effects of doing this. And also, we don't want to be changing genes like this in a population. So most of the genetic editing that we're talking about is you take a person, you might change their skin cells. They're not going to pass that on to their children, you know. Mm. So when they pass on, they don't pass that on, you know. Yeah. So, huge condemnation in the world about it. But funnily enough, there's still, I read an article, I think I sent it to Ed there, that Luke O'Neill had described, which was basically a company that is set up in the US that will screen embryos. So when you do in vitro fertilization, you have a lot of embryos, right? Or you may have a lot of embryos. And they will screen them, you know, for things as they should. But this company will screen them for a number of genes that seem to be involved in intelligence. Right now, that's there's a very loose connection between the genetics of intelligence, because intelligence is really complex and really multifactorial, and probably a huge impact in terms of, like, nature is one thing, but nurture is probably a huge thing as well in terms of somebody's intelligence. So again, there's that aspect as well, where I suppose genetics, and that's not really gene editing, but could be used.
See, that story you just told there would be, I'd imagine, most people's fears with gene editing when that fella goes into the twin babies and messes around with something in secrecy as well. So how are scientists making sure that it's used responsibly going forward?
Yeah, so in terms of, like, scientists and clinicians, if any of us ever want to do sort of studies with humans, the regulations are really tight, like, in terms of what we would have is research ethic boards. And they are made up, so they're in all universities, they're in all hospitals, they're in anywhere where there's, like, any sort of research being done with humans. You have to get ethical approval. And this can, like, these are really onerous things, and as they should be. And the ethical boards, then, I just had a look to kind of refresh my memory of who would be on these. So, like, there's a huge array of expertise on these ethical boards. So there would be doctors, obviously, clinicians, nurses, patient advocates. There's always lay people, people outside, you know, for them to kind of give that input. Oh, hold on, that just doesn't seem right, or whatever, or, you know, I don't think that's going to be of use, you know, in the general population. Obviously, people who've got bioethics experience as well. So there's a whole, people with mental health experience, mental health experts, psychologists. So these boards are really robust, you know, and as I said, yeah, the experiment that was done in China did not follow Chinese regulations. You know, it would not have happened if that person had followed Chinese regulation. And I think it's important that there is such worldwide condemnation when something like that happens, to kind of disenfranchise other people from trying to do this as well. But, you know, it's not like, I think there's this idea that there's these rogue scientists, you know what I mean, like, running around. Obviously, these things it takes a lot of money to do these types of studies as well. So, you know, you have to try to get finance and all of that. So these are things that, like, are barriers as well, you know, because people aren't going to give you finance unless they think things are being done, you know, through the regulatory boards.
Yeah. Call me mad for this question, but how do we...
You're mad, Terrence.
Yeah. How do we make sure that it's not only available to rich people?
Yeah, that's something that I've been thinking about as well. It's this kind of whole idea of health equity, you know. And so, for example, when we talked about the EB situation, so Emma Fogarty with her condition, I just had a look, and a kind of gene editing treatment was just approved for her type of EB, which is dystrophic EB, only like two or three years ago, right? And this is a gene editing treatment that, as we said, makes that collagen 7 less wonky. But the cost of that treatment is $500,000 per patient per year.
Per year?
Per year.
So it's not like a once-off, your genes are just...
No, so you probably have, because the skin cells keep...
reproducing,
well, and I suppose that's it's a good point with most of our cells, like they'll do their bit, they have a certain lifespan, and then they'll die and they get replenished. So when these, and skin particularly really gets replenished, like dust is skin. Mm. Like I had a good thing, which I can't remember now, that we slot off like X amount of skin, like every day, a huge amount. So that's why we have so much dust.
Every 3 weeks or something like that, your skin is completely replaced.
There you go.
Did you say dust is skin?
Dust is skin.
Did you not know that?
Never.
Did you not know that?
Never. Yeah. Dust is skin.
Yeah.
Dust
your skin. Say you take your forearm. So if you go from your wrist to your elbow, every 3 weeks, that's a whole new layer of skin now.
Yeah.
That's because it's a shed. But like, obviously, you're not going to realise that.
Disgusting that is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Listen, we can talk about lots of things that are... Yeah.
Scrubbing the skirt boards and
one of them.
Imagine your bed sheets, so you think about it, like, that's where you're supposed to change your sheets once a week because that's what you're living in.
Oh, I can't believe that. That's going to make me a bit sick.
What are you waiting for it?
I never knew that.
Yeah. No.
Did you not?
No, I did not know that. I thought it was a mixture. So if you're living in a house with like six or seven people, it's all their skin.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
And hair.
I'm moving into a tent.
Yeah.
I know, as Calvin said, you do. You basically, you know, replenish a certain amount every like couple of weeks. So like skin is constant. Like the layer of skin on the upper layer is dead. Like they are dead cells. Like they're not really alive. They're just dead. And then they just slot off and the next ones come up and they die. And then, you know, that's just how
it
happens.
When a cell dies, it splits in two.
Right, yeah.
No, that's not, and that's what's happening. It's replenishing, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's incredible.
I've completely lost my train of thought about the dust.
Oh, you're not sending me west
end, yeah. Dust editing treatments.
Can't wait to go home and tell everyone.
Are you a bit like, are you afraid of blood and stuff?
No, I'm grand with all that, but now dust has become an issue. Instantly.
Do you have a dusty house?
No, but the skirt board, you know.
It'd be like the shaking wagon.
We were talking about getting the Emma Fogarty getting the treatment that costs $500,000 per patient per year.
Yes.
That
yes.
is what we were talking
about. And I was like, per year, I thought it was a once-off treatment.
Yes. And that's how we got to the dust. Sorry, jeekers, I'm glad you got us back on our train of thought there, Calvin. If you think about that, you're like, that's unsustainable for, you know, even, you know, pretty rich countries like ourselves. But if you think about really poor countries, that's just not even part and parcel. So, of course, these treatments will get cheaper as we go along. But I think that's another kind of discussion that needs to happen is, you know, how can health systems, you know, afford these types of treatments and which ones should we bring in and use and which ones, you know, can we just not afford? So, you know, there's a lot of discussion about that.
So for now, it is only available to the rich or for the future.
If you think about, like the cost of, and even, not even just the cost, but, you know, a lot of these treatments as well have to be done in very specialised centres. So when I was talking about the example with cancer, it's a treatment called CAR T cell therapy. And you might have heard of immunotherapy. This is like where you kind of give an agent that activates your immune system and your immune system goes and fights the tumour. What CAR T cell therapy is you take out the individual's T cells. You tinker with that T cell receptor using gene editing and then you put those back in. Like that's not going to be done in regional hospitals in Ireland. Mm. Like that, these are very specialised centres that will just be able to provide these treatments. So again, that's kind of the health inequity, isn't it?
Yeah.
That, you know, these aren't going to be available in a lot of other countries, all right.
Yeah. just asking you personally, what do you think is the most exciting thing for the future of Jane Edithan?
I actually think it's the effect that we can maybe have on the climate. Actually, that is where I think the interesting part is. And I think it's where we're probably going to see probably the biggest impact in terms of impacting lots of people. If you can affect a crop, you know, you could impact hundreds of thousands of people. And I think that's where, and even doing gene editing in things like plants and bacteria to make them, what you had said about the plastics as well,
yeah,
that the bacterium can be changed.
When you were going to the toilet, you're talking about this. It's all right, people know we take toilet breaks.
Take a toilet break every week, it's always been Annie, yeah.
Is it?
That used to me, yeah.
Yeah. So when Annie mentioned the oil spill, and if you could train the enzymes to go in and clean up the oil spill, they're working on one now that eats plastic. So, like, you know, plastic that's floating in the oceans and all, if you just pour all these enzymes into the ocean, it'll go in and eat all the plastic in the ocean.
Hell.
So they're actually doing that's
even
a thing.
You know, bacteria that can create fuel. You know, there is bacteria that can create certain types of fuel. And again, you can use gene editing, you know, to enhance those properties. So, or like, you know, what you can look at for is if there's a certain bacterium that's really good at, like, spitting out a protein, you know, but you want a human protein, you know, made. Well, we can use bacteria to do that. And that is already being done, all right, quite a bit. But gene editing will probably give us more scope to do that. Mm. But yeah, definitely the climate stuff, you know, the food, how we can affect, you know, carbon, you know, emissions, all of that stuff. I think that's where gene editing will kind of move away from this scary designer baby idea, where people will see like this is something that's really, you know, promising and really beneficial.
Yeah, so that's what you think is the most exciting things for the future. What's some of the biggest challenges you think it faces in terms of even public perception of it?
Yeah, like I think there's probably a need to publicize the wins that we have already. So like even things that are quite expensive, when they are shown to be effective, that we talk about them, you know, we show the effect that they have had on people. Like, for example, if you think about Emma Fogarty, you know, if she was like, I don't think anyone could have watched her on The Late Late Show and not feel huge empathy, you know, for the condition that she has and how difficult that is every day to get up and to live. And if gene editing can help her get back to a more normal life, I think then it's really important that we talk about that and we say that this is due to gene editing. You know, like to give gene editing its place in the sun where it is deserved, and like, you know, changing crops for the better. So that we're not hearing about designer babies and, you know, goofy looking tomatoes and all of that. We're really hearing about how these things are being used for the good.
Mm. Yeah.
See, you mentioned the AI earlier, and there's governments now discussing about putting like rules and regulations in place. So like to limit AI. So like you can't just take everybody's jobs and all these like scary things. Is gene editing something that's being discussed in like governments, and are you putting like rules and regulations in place there?
Well, I think there's already a lot. I think with the ethical boards and regulatory boards, there's already a lot of rules and regulations there. To answer your question, Calvin, I don't know if that will happen. I don't think governments are necessarily speaking about gene editing. I think they'll be talking about gene editing when some of these treatments come on their desk with the price tag that they have. I think then we'll be talking about gene editing technologies. Yeah. All right.
Right. Are we now going into the mad stuff now?
Thought we did with the dust.
Yeah, I'm hearing you can put a monkey's head on a German Shepherd, Annie. I don't know how true it is.
Now, come out. I was
a
asked.
A monkey's head on a what?
A German Shepherd.
All right. Yeah,
but
I was asked to ask that question. So I walked in this building today, and the first thing somebody said to me was, when Annie comes in, ask her, could you put a monkey's head on an XL bully? And I was like, what? It was Ed who asked me to ask.
Yeah, thanks, Les.
Yeah, we just throw him under the bus. Yeah. Welcome.
I'm not having people listen to this and be like, why did they ask that?
No.
Ed.
Oh, right. That's it. I'm going to edit all of that.
No, yeah. No. And certainly that wouldn't be gene editing. Like putting something on something else isn't gene editing. So like you could take your German Shepherd, right? And you could gene edit it maybe, I don't know, to have a different colour fur or something like that.
So you can't do like a Jurassic Park on it?
I don't think you could. No, absolutely.
That'd be exciting if you could, but wouldn't it?
I know. But I don't think you would want to either.
Nah,
you know what I mean?
You wouldn't.
You know, I always say just because you can, you don't have to.
Yeah.
You know
what I
mean? No, that makes sense. Especially those, don't let us in there that.
Yeah, like I genuinely coming in here, I was thinking that you could say, because you were talking about the designer babies, I was thinking you could just find like the running gene and then like the height gene and then be like, I want my baby to have that and have that and have this and have that. And like you just put the order in, like, not that you can't.
Put the order.
No, but like, and whatever you're having yourself, like, do you know, I thought like that could be a possibility. Yeah. Is that like a possibility, as in theoretically, not like, oh, this is what's coming down the line? Is that theoretically?
It's, you know, achievable. Like even if we talk about, if we go back to that example of where they're sort of screening embryos for intelligence, right? Like they're looking at 500 genes, you know, and it may, and they're actually saying that even if they get that right combination of the 500 genes, I think the IQ will go from, they predict that the IQ of somebody, I think average IQ is 100. I know you guys are probably tipping up around the 120 or whatever, but the average IQ is 100. And they were saying that even if you did all of this perfectly right, you might get to an IQ of 106. So I just, there's so much that we don't know, which is a good thing, you know what I mean, in some way.
Just like, leave it alone kind of thing. Just leave it alone.
Don't get carried away.
Yeah.
You know, I just, exactly. I think it's very, I think that hype stories get all the, they get all the fuel.
Yeah.
But they are the absolute exceptions. Like, they are the one in a million stories,
Like, going back to what Terrence was saying about the rich, if it came out in a month's time that Kim Kardashian was designing a baby, you wouldn't be surprised.
No.
You wouldn't be.
Yeah.
Doing
this,
she's screening embryos for intelligence and she's putting in this gene and that gene. I'd be like, yeah, I could see them doing that.
Yeah, but she couldn't put in the genes. That's the thing. Like, she actually couldn't. That would be unlawful, you know, to put in genes. Yes, in the US. You can't do it here. In the US, I think you can screen the embryos. But like, you might have somebody, you might screen all these embryos for intelligence, okay? And you might get a child who might be a bit smarter, but might have really bad anger issues. Like, because combination is not great, do you see? So
so that's the risk you take.
Exactly.
Or you don't take.
Kim.
Annie, I think you've done a great job because I feel like an expert.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah.
I feel like an expert.
I'll be looking out for all those Alsatians. Or German Shepherd.
Annie, we appreciate you coming in and trying to drag us up to speed where you're at. We know it's you're well ahead in this, but
I hope so.
Yeah. But as Terry said, my head is spinning just thinking about all this, you know.
Oh,
so like, I'll be looking out for it now. Yeah. John, when it comes up in the news and they're like, oh, and in the government today, be like, should have rang us.
I know. Experts.
We could have been the consultants.
Yeah.
There's a few quid in that for us. But no, thanks for coming in. We really appreciate it.
That's
it.
Very much, Annie.
Yeah, no, great to meet you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Annie for coming in and enlightening us. And thanks to Science Week 2024.
Science Week is a national celebration of science with hundreds of events for people of all ages taking place across Ireland from the 10th to the 17th of November.
From protecting our natural world, creating more sustainable approaches to energy supply, embracing technological advancements and investigating new solutions to safeguard our health, it's time to reimagine the way we engage with the world around us and enhance our collective strengths.
Let's celebrate our innate ability to reinvent, rejuvenate and regenerate. For more information about Science Week 2024 and a full list of events taking place, visit scienceweek.ie.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Try your way in it now. Fill your body up. Walk it hard and low. When you finish that.
The hip knocker.
This is an advertisement for BetterHelp Therapy Online. There are so many things that kids are curious about and they just have no fear diving in to learn something new.
Yeah, like how to do a wheelie.
And then as we grow older, we don't take the time out to learn new things. But curiosity doesn't have to be lost at childhood. Thankfully, therapy can help you reconnect with your inner child and get you excited to learn and grow again.
Now, I might not be able to teach you how to do a wheelie, but it helps give you the skills to get back on the bike no matter how many times you've fallen off.
If you're thinking about starting therapy, then why not give BetterHelp a try?
All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge.
And it's entirely online, making it convenient, flexible and suitable no matter your schedule.
With over 5,000 therapists available, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise.
Rediscover your curiosity with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/bollocks to get 10% off your first month.
That's betterhelp.com/BOLLOX.